Media Network Plus.
Hello there, and welcome to the program. We begin in Fiji. The Fiji Media Association is calling on members of the public to respect the work of journalists in the country. This comes after the latest attack on a journalist in the country, the third time this has happened in the past 2 months. Filming a man sentenced on a corruption case earlier last week, the Fiji Broadcasting Corporation journalist Pratata Bakash was struck in the stomach with a stone thrown by a remand prisoner. The prisoner was under police escort at the time. Police refused to take action even as the prisoner swore and verbally abused the journalist. The Fiji Media Association's General Secretary Stanley Simpson told Corey Hawkins, police must do more to protect journalists and to take threats and attacks against them seriously.
The people who threw the stone at her, they were in police remand, so they were in police custody, and the police should have taken better care to ensure that the journalist and the public was protected from any actions from these people.
And what have the police said?
Well, the police have said that they are taking the matter seriously and they will be looking into it.
Right, and is this from the Fiji Media Association's perspective, is this something that happens often?
Yes, the concern for us from the Fijian Media Association is that this has become a consistent event now. This is the third event in the last 2 months where a Fiji TV reporter that was manhandled a few weeks ago, and then a Fiji Sun reporter was accosted, and then now the incident with the FBC journalist. So it's a worrying trend. Now these areas in the courthouse, they tend to be a flashpoint area because, you know, the relatives of the there's a lot of tension. They're there, they wish to protect their loved ones, while the journalists are arriving there to do their job. And so it's always an area where there's a lot of verbal confrontation, so to speak. However, this has escalated to an extent where a stone was thrown, and that raises this issue to another level.
So the call here is for the public to better appreciate and respect the jobs of journalists?
Our call here is, you know, to more awareness that the public needs to respect the work of journalists and the role that journalists play. I mean, they're an integral part in ensuring in seeing that justice is served, to ensure that a fair trial is taking place, that both sides are being heard, and that the public is seeing that the wheels of justice are turning. So it's very important that the public appreciate the role that they play and the challenges they face.
And for the police to protect journalists as they would any other citizen.
Yes, we are now calling on the police force to please do a bit more in ensuring that the journalists are protected, especially around that area.
Right, and the journalist herself, she's okay?
Yeah, she's okay. I mean, she obviously she was shaken. But the next day she was reporting again from the courthouse.
One aspect of reporting that is actually very difficult for most journalists is actually reporting on security and intelligence issues. Now, in some countries, this is actually illegal. I'm speaking of, let's say, countries like China. But in the United States, Canada, Australia, most of Europe, it isn't illegal. The problem, though, is trying to get people on the record from various intelligence agencies to speak candidly without giving too many details about ongoing investigations. Otherwise, you would just hear no comment all the time. Richard Ady speaks next to Bernard Kane. He's the Canberra correspondent for Crikey.com.
What we tend to get in a lot of cases, I think, is what Glenn Greenwald calls stenography journalism, where the claims of intelligence officials and national security officials are conveyed verbatim and without attempts to provide context, attempts to provide history, which might reveal contradictions from previous positions or flaws in arguments, and without any sort of critical analysis. And Australia has a relatively small media sector. Mm. Our national newspapers, we only have two national newspapers. We only have, you know, a few more significant papers. The number of journalists who can actually apply themselves to what is an incredibly important field of national security journalism is very small. And there is, I think one of the other problems is there's no depth to the sort of journalism that we're seeing. And of course, that's a problem not just in national security intelligence journalism. Mm. That's a problem right across the industry.
But Bernard, there's some good journalists who cover this area. Surely some are better than others.
Well, take someone like Brendan Nicholson, for example, who works for the Australian on defence and national security issues. Excellent journalist, excellent contacts within the military establishment, produces very high quality journalism. But he's somewhat atypical of it. Dylan Welsh, who for a long time wrote for Fairfax, then went to Afghanistan for a while, and I think has since returned, was also very good on national security affairs. But unfortunately, they're atypical in the sense of both a grounding in the area and a willingness and capacity to actually engage critically with the issues that are being raised, because this is an area where you need both specialist knowledge and you need a willingness to actually interrogate what we are being told by security officials, because that particular sector of government gets very little scrutiny. This is a broader problem, not just about journalism, but about parliamentary scrutiny as well. Mm. Intelligence agencies and national security agencies get much less parliamentary scrutiny than other sections of the public service. And that, if anything, should put more pressure on journalists to actively apply scrutiny to these agencies, and somehow it doesn't.
Well, I'll come back to that because it might point to a wider cultural issue. But let's work through the journalism end of it, because surely, by its nature, this information, it's at the extreme end of the difficult-to-get scale, which means that if you're not getting it from the person you're interrogating, there's often no alternative source.
There are two dimensions to this issue. One is that, yes, this is a sector where we are asked to take on trust the claims of intelligence officials. Now, that is a spectrum. That's not a single point. In the United States, for example, I think there is a much healthier approach both to the public scrutiny that I talked about, but also the journalistic scrutiny of the claims of intelligence officials. But I think in Australia, journalists are much more reluctant to push the envelope when it comes to the very great unwillingness of national security agencies to provide additional information.
Do you think the journalists are captured, and this happens in every field, where you are given information off the record, strictly off the record, and that makes it then quite difficult to use that information if your source won't then go on the record?
Well, there is, and the capture also extends to the fact that if you breach confidence or are perceived to have in any way broken the rules, then you can be punished by not being given further information. And this isn't just confined to the Australian media. I mean, this is a problem with the Western media in general. I mean, look no further than the extraordinary sight of the New York Times, one of the world's great sort of media organs, taking the WikiLeaks cables to the State Department and basically getting the State Department to tick off on what they could report within certain parameters, rather than making their own judgment about what was in the public interest in terms of publication. So the concept of capture, it really revolves around the form of exchange journalism that goes on between officials and journalists.
Yes, and Judy Miller got led down the garden path, of course, in the lead up to the Iraq war. Could it be, though, that there's another interest? In that, if there's a national security story, especially a scary one, that makes, well, it makes for compelling copy, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And we're seeing that right at the moment with the even absolutely trivial stories about Islamic State flags, for example, let alone arrests for, we don't know, but likely for providing support or planning to send people to Syria, are beaten up into stories that more or less imply that Australians were being beheaded in the streets. I mean,
not quite.
Well, I mean, the dimension of this is a clear and present threat to Australians is very strong in both these stories and what we're hearing from the government. And that's a key element to the government's arguments about the need to return to Iraq. And it was fascinating to see at least one News Corporation journalist, Cameron Stewart, talking about the impact of front page headlines about jihadis on bringing Australians round to the idea of supporting intervention in Iraq. So this sense of clear and present threat, I think, is an important component in changing the way people view national security issues, as well as, you're absolutely right, as well as being great copy.
Mm. Ben, you mentioned context earlier. What about the context around this? Is this different after September 11 or even the Bali bombing, or have we always been a bit like this?
I think we in Australia we've always been somewhat obsequious toward national security officials. I mean, the thing to bear in mind about these officials is they are bureaucrats. In many cases, they are bureaucrats who have worked in other areas of the public service. I mean, there isn't a special breed of intelligence bureaucrat. There are oftentimes you'll find they've worked in areas in foreign affairs and in attorney generals. These are public servants, and yet they are not held to the same sort of standards of scrutiny as other public servants. And I think that's long been the case.
So is it part of something wider, part of our culture, that although we like to have this image of ourselves as, you know, challenging authority and larrikins, but actually mention national security and we get all serious and obedient?
Well, I think we follow on from the Brits in that regard. I mean, I think despite, you know, a lot of the issues around the reporting, for example, of the Snowden revelations in the US, that the US has a much healthier culture, both in the press and at a congressional level, about debating security issues and intelligence issues. I mean, it's much more open there.
But I suppose from the reporting point of view, if this is cultural, if this is embedded in part of being part of the Anglosphere in Australia, then it's not something that can easily be fixed by a couple of reporters deciding to go a bit harder.
No, it needs to be driven by politicians. For example, one of the problems that we've got in discussing, let's take, for example, the issue of the ASIS whistleblower and Bernard Collaery, who were raided by ASIO late last year. The problem with the media getting to grips with that story is that George Brandis, the Attorney General, can at any stage simply throw up the shutters and say, this is an operational issue, I'm not discussing this. He will get away with that in a way that a similar blank refusal to engage on the issues would not be tolerated by the media elsewhere, or if not tolerated, then it certainly would draw very strong comment. And yet, because there's this tradition of accepting politicians who say, look, I'm not going to talk further about this, this is a security matter, you know, it's very difficult to actually have a debate about these sorts of issues. That's why, you know, quite significant revelations from Edward Snowden about the actions of Australian intelligence agencies, like Australian Signals Directorate, like ASIS, really have not sparked anything like the debate that we've seen, certainly in the US and also, for that matter, in the UK, in the Australian public space about what the remit of our intelligence agencies should be, what sort of mass surveillance that they should be engaged in.
Richard Ady there speaking to Bernard Keane about reporting critically on security and intelligence issues. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
All right. When you think about countries putting satellites into space, well, there's actually a few countries that, well, most countries have actually put satellites into space at some point or another, but it's usually used through, they usually do it through certain countries. Now, most satellites are either made in a few places. They're either made in Canada, the European Union, China, Russia, and now India. But if I mention Australia, well, that's not exactly a satellite manufacturing company, country that would come to mind. But now, Australian-made satellites are about to launch into space. Dr. Matthew Tetlow is the project leader from the University of Australia. He spoke to Fran Kelly from the ABC.
Well, the payloads, or the reason they're up there, is to do a scientific mission. And there are three different payloads, all developed in Europe, and they're all collecting information about slightly different parts of the thermosphere. So some of them are measuring electron density, some of them are measuring oxygen concentrations, and some of them are measuring oxygen and nitrogen concentrations.
To what end? What will we learn from that?
Well, basically because the thermosphere is not very well understood at the moment, and because it's part of the atmosphere, it affects anything down to, you know, tropical storms or anything like that. So it's part of the model that is what drives our weather.
Can you tell me a bit more about the thermosphere? So it's not space, it's not what we think of as space?
No, well, it's a very, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but it's a very thin, very, very low density area of the atmosphere. So as you go up, obviously it's very dense down in where we live, and it gets progressively less and less dense as you go out. And the atmosphere continues all the way up until really about 600 kilometres, but it's extremely very low density out there. So it's just kind of this region kind of on the edge of where it's been explored so far, essentially.
Okay. These tiny satellites, they're called CubeSats. I guess that means they're a cube shape. Could you describe what a CubeSat looks like?
Well, the cube refers to a 100 by 100 by 100 millimeter cube. So they're typically made up of numbers of those cubes. So a one unit is just a single unit, 100 by 100 by 100. And then a two unit is basically two of them together, so 200 by 100 by 100. And then a 3U, 300 by 100 by 100. And then you can go all the way up to, you know, 27U.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically, it's just a standard form factor so that it fits into a particular deployer. So it's much cheaper to launch them because it's always the same interface. So as long as you conform to that standard, then there's a range of different launch service providers who will just sort of slot your spacecraft in and then launch it.
Okay, so we are part of this this row of CubeSats that will be launched at the end of the week. This technology, is there been breakthroughs at the site where you are, University of Adelaide or ANU or UNSW, the Australian research? Is there anything groundbreaking about it?
Yes. I mean, each of the universities are doing their own special sub-experiments. So the QB50 mission was interesting where they said they basically got enough money to build payloads and to launch them, and then they went to the world and said, who can build a spacecraft to fly our sensors?
Mm-hmm.
And so we put our hand up, as did UNSW and USID. And that basically, the opportunity there was that they would launch our satellite and we could put our own payloads on it as well. So it was only, there wasn't only space for the QB50 payload. We could build our own. Each university could build their own. So all the universities did all sorts of small experiments in addition to the major experiment. And so I can't speak to the other two universities. I don't know enough about them. But ours was a GPS-based experiment to measure water vapor in the atmosphere just by measuring the delay time between GPS signals going through the atmosphere to our spacecraft.
So that's what one of the satellites that you've built will do there in the thermosphere.
Yeah,
and
correct.
Is that tied into study of climate change? Is that about climate?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about weather modeling and climate and how things are moving. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of data about the thermosphere to date to use as a reference. But from it gives us a really good understanding of today's climate and then of the model of the thermosphere today. And then in future years, you could, you know, do similar missions and then sort of then build up an understanding of how if the climate's changing or not.
You're listening to RN Breakfast. It's 20 past 8. Our guest is Dr. Matthew Tatelow, project head at the University of Adelaide, one of the team who designed one of the three Australian-made satellites. Space exploration, Matthew, has been about big agencies in the past taking huge funds. The development of these nano-satellites, does that change who's involved in this industry? Does it allow smaller players in? Are we going to see a change of where space exploration is being done and who's funding it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, Australia was in the forefront of the original space in the sort of 50s and 60s, but we dropped the ball then. And then with the emergence of this, what we call new space, we kind of have an opportunity now to get back into the game, basically, and build up a skill set around it. So, I mean, there are a number of missions where nanosatellites are just not feasible or they can't do the job of a large spacecraft. But the concept of this sort of disaggregated system where you have, instead of one large, you have several small satellites doing the same job is one that's a number of applications are now sort of being able to be used with this philosophy. So I think they call it new space, and it, you know, it's attractive because you have low-cost satellites, low-cost launch. This is all relative to big satellites,
of course.
And also it's agile. So, you know, you can put up a constellation in pieces, and as technology changes, you can modify it. And because they're not that expensive, then you can just essentially throw away or deorbit the old ones. and keep up with, I guess, the most modern technology or the latest way of thinking.
And does your development of these CubeSats, does that, as the South Australian government's got a bit of a strategy, hasn't it, about becoming a major hub for a national space industry?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been getting a lot of support from the government. In fact, the government funded the majority of the RQB50 mission as well. So they sort of see it, you know, there's opportunities for advanced manufacturing and just technology development. Once you have this ecosystem of space in the state, then it'll then encourage all the researchers, for example, to come on board. And because right. there's a mission happening, they could potentially get their research onto the mission, and this basically grows the space economy, essentially.
Well, in terms of that, it's been 15 years since the last Australian satellites were launched into space. Later today, the Space Industry Association of Australia will release a white paper calling for an urgent government commitment to a permanent national space program. What do you think the chances are that Australia will get a national space program, and what are the imperatives for it?
The chances, that's a hard one. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the likelihood of something going ahead is, but I think it's very important to have some sort of agency that's responsible for space. So at the moment, there's no agency that's remit is to promote space or to get, you know, things happening in space. So as a result, you kind of go between all the different other Department of Industry, Department of Foreign Affairs, whatever. You've got to get sort of export control and all these licenses from a whole lot of different entities who are stakeholders in, you know, anything exported. And also there's nobody who's sort of driving the space research or putting seed money into it or anything like that. So
is that a missed opportunity that we're not?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, just about every other nation has some form of agency who basically is there to bat for space, and we don't have that, and I think something needs to be set up to do that.
Matthew Tetlow, thank you very much for joining us.
Matthew Tetlow from the University of Adelaide speaking to Fran Kelly about Australian-made satellites and them being launched into space. I wonder if they could be launched with a kangaroo aboard. Anyway, you are listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International. Now, in May, we actually have a big change coming to PCJ, and that is our website. As you're probably aware, our website hasn't changed at all for the past 7 years. It's going to be getting a complete makeover. Well, not just a complete makeover. I mean, everything is going to be changing on it, and we're going to be relaunching it in May. Now, at the moment, we're still working on some ideas of what we can include. Now, for this program, Media Network Plus, we want to make it an interactive page. So if you have any ideas how to make the Media Network portion of the website interactive, let us know, mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can also let us know through the PCJ Radio International Facebook page. Just do a search for that, PCJ Radio International, and let us know what you think and any ideas that you have. All right, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation, what has been happening and what we can expect. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through March 25th. Normal at low latitudes, normal to fair at middle and high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through March 25th, magnetic conditions quiet to unsettled, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through March 26th, solar activity very low. Geomagnetic activity generally unsettled to active through March 25th, with a 50% chance of minor geomagnetic storms on March 24th. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active on March 25th, 28th, 31st, April 8th and 12th. Quiet on March 26th, April 6th, 7th, 9th and 10th. Quiet to unsettled, March 27th, April 1st, 2nd and 4th. Active to disturbed on March 29th, 30th and April 3rd. Mostly quiet on April 5th and 11th. From SWPC in Boulder, G1 minor geomagnetic storm levels likely on March 28th to 31st and April 2nd, while G2 moderate geomagnetic storm levels are likely March 28th and 29th. ANK indices peaking at 30 and 6. Lowest AZNKs of 5 and 2 on March 25th and not again until April 7th to 15th. Solar flux 72 through April 4th, then down to 70 by April 6th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting along the coast of Namibia, March 24th to 28th. Along the Texas and Louisiana Gulf Coast, March 26th. Around Cabo Verde, March 27th and 28th. Off the west coast of Mexico on March 28th. And all week between Oman and India, and India to Myanmar.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of the program. Yes, it ends very, very quickly, I find. It's almost like we just started a few minutes ago. Actually, we did start a few minutes ago, just about 25 minutes ago, but it flew by. I hope it flew by for you. Anyway, if you want to contact us with your story ideas or suggestions, or to let us know how you heard the program, please do so. Our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well, saying so long, take care, and of course, 73, and let's not forget 88 for the ladies.
Yeah.